Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 306, featuring Babak Bina, senior 3D generalist, director, and instructor, who is a really interesting and cool guy, right?
Oh, awesome. Yeah. I want to be his friend.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. You should have seen the video. Well, those of you who are watching the video, you'll see it, but you should watch the video. He has all these guitars and instruments behind him. I like how people sort of like dressing up their home office backgrounds mm-hmm. to sort of mimic what they're looking at.
I love it.
You know, and that's kind of awesome too. Mm-hmm. What do you think of Babak?
Well, I was saying artists are artists. Like he went from music to CG. He's just so creative. And his story mm-hmm. is like, it's fun. And I felt like it was mesmerizing. Cause he just really has a passion for what he does. And he's worked with like huge VFX companies and like amazing yep. shows and movies. And then also how we found out about him was through the Gnomon Workshop, and he does the right. creating fantasy creatures there. He teaches that. So I want to watch one cause I love creatures.
Yeah. It's really great. Mm-hmm. It's really great. I was an alumni of the Gnomon Workshop, and I did my own set of DVDs at the time.
Yeah,
that were really great, and so it was really cool to see what he's doing, do that. I also really like. Remember, we talked about what things that inspire him, and to him, it was Tool that was interesting.
Yeah,
like, music of Tool that interested him, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's like that's what drove his career. It's like, that's an interesting way to get to what you're doing. So I really thought it was fascinating. Really great guy. Very interesting. I love his work. And it was great. And I think this was another one of Lynette's recommendations for us. So I really appreciate Lynette giving us some great inspiring guests on our podcast. Okay, we got a couple of announcements. What's going on, Kristen?
Yeah, so you can find this out at chaosgroup.com/events on January 12th. 2021. Oh my gosh. We have a free webinar mm-hmm. for V-Ray 5 for Rhino.
That's again, yeah. chaosgroup.com/events. That's where you get all that information. So make sure and check it out. We have a couple of announcements that I've mentioned before, but I want to reiterate them in case you didn't hear them. Vantage is out. Vantage is what used to be called Project Lavina. It is now called Vantage. And it's our first complete standalone application, which is a fully real-time, fully ray-traced application, which is really cool. And in order to celebrate its launch, we are launching a competition called the Building Utopia Competition. And it is, we're doing that in conjunction with our friends at CG Architect. And it's buildingutopia.cgarchitect.com. And the other people who are partnering us with on this is, of course, our friends at Lenovo and NVIDIA and Kitbash 3D. So it's a lot of fun. I spent a lot of time working on this. I actually love this project, and I think it'd be really cool. You guys should totally check it out and be part of the Building Utopia competition. Again, that's buildingutopia.cgarchitect.com. V-Ray 5 for SketchUp is also out. So if you guys want to check that out, I'd be very curious what you guys think about that. And then lastly, if you guys are getting some new hardware during the holidays, you should check out V-Ray Benchmark and see how your new hardware can stack up to the other pieces of hardware out there. So V-Ray Benchmark has been updated with V-Ray 5. It now does 3 tests instead of 2. Basically, it's a CPU test, a CUDA test, and an RTX test. And we've updated a whole bunch of things on the benchmark. So go check it out on our site as well. And that's benchmark.chaosgroup.com, I believe, is the link for that. Okay. If people want to find out more about the podcast, Kristen, where can they go?
You can go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast or chaosgroup.com/CG Garage.
Perfect. And if you guys have ideas or other things you would like to talk about, to let us know about, go to labs@chaosgroup.com and you can get all the information there. Again, that's labs@chaosgroup.com. And of course, don't forget to give us a rating and review on Apple Podcast and, share us with all your friends and tell us what you think. Remember, these are in video format now, so you can check us out in video. There you go. Before we sign off, Kristen and I would like to wish you all a happy holidays because we are recording this. This episode should be coming out just before the holidays. So hopefully you guys had happy and very safe and healthy holiday.
Welcome to another CG Garage where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're going to fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fernell.
Thank you so much for doing this. This has been awesome.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I'm glad we were able to get this this going and to see, you know, what you guys are doing, you know, over at Noman and, you know, all the stuff. But I'd really love to know more about your career. Obviously, I can see behind you, you've got a passion for music as well. what sort of got you, you know, into the art and to doing all the things that are happening in your life and got you where you are now?
Right. I mean, it's a very long story. I don't know if I should start from a long time ago.
You can start for as long as you want. You know, I mean, I had someone tell me the other day that they got into it when they won a McDonald's competition at the age of 3 for a drawing. So I don't know how far back you want to go.
Okay. No, I'm not going to go that far back because then we're going to be here for a long time. So I'm coming from Iran. So I immigrated to Canada 2004.
Uh-huh.
And back in Iran, I was doing civil engineering in university.
Okay.
And then...
Around what year is this approximately?
This is 1990, like around 2000, I think.
Okay.
And at the same time, I always wanted to play, actually, I don't know if... I always wanted to play drums, but... Because we have always been living in apartments, it was not an option. So I decided to play guitar, and my guitar teacher turned me into a lot of interesting, cool bands. And he was bringing me, and I'm talking about Iran, of course, there was there's not a lot. Like, he was bringing me like bootleg tapes of some bands, and I was listening to them. And one of the bands that really got me excited was Tool. And and that actually like completely changed my life, because that's when I decided that I wanted to do art.
How did Tool lead you to art?
Well, you know, they have like really interesting music videos, and I'm talking about 97 to 2000, around that time. And in Iran, we didn't have like much of an internet. We have dial-up connection, but it was like really, really heavily filtered and all that. So I was researching into this band, and I figured that, you know, the guitar player makes the music videos, the guitar player makes the album cover, and the music itself. One particular album, Anima, was just mind-blowing to me, and I didn't know what to make of it. It was totally strange and alien to me, and it was really, at the same time, really attractive and mysterious. So I decided to like dig deeper into Tool and see what they're about. So I went online, I read a bunch of FAQs with the band and reading lists, and I started collecting the books that they suggested on analytical psychology and mythology. I started reading Jung and Joseph Campbell, and I started reading History of Art.
Wow, you went down a rabbit hole.
Yeah. Took it really seriously.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, absolutely.
And that all led me to... And then, like, their album covers were really also intriguing to me, and very expressive, but very, like, minimalistic, but you know, expressive. So I don't know if you've seen the album cover for Undertow. That was what got me excited about doing sculptures, actually.
Okay.
And as I mentioned, I was studying civil engineering, and this was like, I was not happy in university. So I was like, okay, I'm going to switch probably to something creative. So I on my own, I started learning sculpture. I got clay. I started sculpting, and I thought, yeah, this is kind of the calling, and I think this is the thing I want to do.
Interesting.
And yeah, and then that got me into art. And then at the same time, I always wanted to immigrate, because, you know, Iran is you know, it's a third world country, and it's got its own problems and everything.
Right.
I don't want to go into, and always wanted to come out. So at the same time, I knew that I was going to do something creative. So I I got an offer from a college in Toronto for graphic design. And okay. I went to Toronto, studied graphic design for 2 years as an international student. And then I always wanted to do sculpture because all the meantime I was doing, sculpting on my own. Yep. And so after that graphic design was finished, sorry if it's too long. It's like
No, keep story. Going. I'll get you where we need to go now. Yeah, plenty of time.
Yeah, and I went to sculpture, and then while I was studying at York University, studying sculpture, I was like, okay, I was international student, the tuition was super high, and I didn't have permission to work, so I had to like spend money from my own account, and it wasn't a stable thing to do. And at the same time, I was like, okay, when I finish this, what's going to happen after if I become a sculptor? How am I going to, how am I going to make money? What's the practical solution to this? And then because I had like this computer background too, like ever since childhood, I was exposed to computers. And I remember when I was like maybe 10, 11, I was using 3D Studio under DOS. Mm-hmm.
Who I talked to yesterday on a podcast was Gary Yost, the guy who invented 3D Studio.
Oh wow!
Yeah,
that's crazy.
So,
yeah.
So he and I had a long conversation yesterday. So I know exactly because that's what I learned. I learned in that's one of the big first 3D packages was DOS. So,
yeah. With there was this scene of Empire State Building in 3D Studio under DOS. Uh-huh.
Yeah,
remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So like that time, right? So I was doing on the side, I was interested in computer graphics, and then when I was thinking about the practical solution to like going forward, I decided to enroll in 3D animation. So I enrolled in 3D animation at Seneca College in Toronto in 2009, and then studied for a year and got my first job in a TV studio in Toronto.
Yeah.
So that is my gateway into like visual effects and film.
Okay.
And then
what were you doing for the TV station?
So I'm like a 3D generalist kind of person. So, asset build. From modeling to texturing to look dev.
Okay.
Sometimes
mostly graphic design stuff or
It wasn't for motion graphics. It was actually they were producing their own shows for children.
Oh, okay.
And they were writing the story and filming it and also doing the post for it as well. So everything
Got
was
it.
Done within the companies. It was everything was their own production.
Right.
That was a good experience to like dive into different sections of 3D. So I was sometimes doing even like dynamics and lighting. I had to be able to juggle between different tasks.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I always wanted to go to film. So I applied to Scanline in Vancouver, and I got an offer. And I came to Vancouver 2014. So that's 10 years after I immigrated to Canada.
Yeah.
And then been here since. And I have switched to a couple of different studios. I went to DNEG, I went to Method.
Yeah.
But Scanline has always been like a place that I go back to. So I was in Scanline and then I moved to DNEG and then moved back to Scanline and then Method.
Yeah. I've been to the Scanline office. I don't know if it's the same though.
Which office did you go to?
Oh, I don't remember. I don't remember. So, Stefan and Danny were touring around.
Yeah. That was in downtown in Homer and Smythe.
Yes.
Yeah. Now they have changed, and of course now we are working. Remotely. Yeah.
Yeah. How's that working? So you're still at Scanline right now, right?
I am still at Scanline, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. And so how has that been working for you, working remotely, et cetera?
It's like, it's quite, the thing is, we have always, even at the office, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, actually.
Well, we can cut it out if you don't.
Yeah, I mean, remotely, we our computers were in LA, right? So we were working remotely.
Oh, right.
And we only needed the box that was that we were connecting to, like Teradici boxes.
Right.
You know, that's something that we're using now. And it not like office is spread. So, you know, it's not one unified location, but everybody's like working from home. But it's at the same time, it kind of feels the same, except for people are not around you. But everybody is like, because even at the office, people sometimes prefer to call you or chat with you.
Yep.
So you can do all those things. Mm-hmm. Except for the fact that, you know, you cannot go for like lunch break together or things like that.
But it's true, though. A lot of offices, you know, were already had a lot of their computers in data centers, right? So remoting in was not necessarily a thing. But now you have to do it from home. So now suddenly you have to have like, you know, a good internet connection at home to be able to deal with that, right?
Yeah. I mean, I have also, I was I have moved to this house that you're seeing now.
Yeah.
In August, and yeah, when I moved, I got a very good like internet connection for it too. Yeah. But the house is kind of big, so like we had to like install these like receivers in different parts of the house to be able to access.
So you do like a mesh network of some kind, or
yeah.
Well, that's cool. I mean, I think it's interesting that people are finding ways to, you know, work from home and doing you know, making things work. I've had mixed reactions. Some people say this is great because now I don't have to deal with commutes. I don't have to deal with certain things. And then some people are like, no, I really need to see people in person. I'm missing out or not as efficient. I'm really curious about
what
that's like. You like it?
Yeah, I'm a fan of it. And to be honest with you, like this is it has always been my dream to like just have my own schedule, kind of like be able to like, if I want to work at 2 a.m. like be able to do that, or if I wanted to like start at 11, I would be able to do that. Of course, I'm not doing that every day, but I mean the option is good to have.
Yes,
to be able to adjust to your own, you know, comfortable
your own schedule
time,
But the other thing, you know, I noticed, for example, is that I you know, I live in LA and I have to do, you know, had to deal with long commutes as a lot of people do. And now I've got about 2.5 hours of my day where I'm not driving.
Oh man. Oh, well, that's great then.
So that's great, right?
So
taking on extra work or doing on an extra project or coming up with a new hobby or, you know, doing some side projects, those all become much more possible with that free time.
Yeah.
And you're starting to do, I mean, you started teaching at Noman, right? So you started doing cuts. So how is that? Like, actually, what's it like being a remote teacher? Because my kids are remote learning right now behind me, but what's it like being a remote teacher?
Well, I'm creating tutorials for Noman. So I'm not like I'm in Noman workshop.
You're in the workshop.
Basically workshop. But, well, we'll get to that because Noman is pretty amazing, and I have started learning ZBrush with Noman tutorials, and it's now really exciting to be able to actually teach tutorials. You know, it came full circle, kind of.
Yep.
But I am teaching in a college in Vancouver, remotely. 2 days, 2 days per week. I'm having like 3 hour classes.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest with you, it's interesting because you don't see the students and you don't know if they're there or not at all.
Yep.
And also, like, you're not able to, let's say if they want to ask questions, they have to share their screen, and sometimes it doesn't really work well.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, you want permission to like control their computer to be able to help them, and sometimes it doesn't work. There are technical problems that, you know, you have to be aware of. And you get used to it. It's like, it's challenging. It was more challenging in the beginning than now, because this is the second term I started, kind of started like a month ago. It's the second term. Second term has been more streamlined because everybody's like more prepared for it. And And I guess in time, maybe the tools will improve to adapt to our situation of like working from home, right. And the better tools mean that it probably is going to be not that difficult, even though I would like to go on campus and see the students. These students that I had, I've never seen them because we started during COVID.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's strange. My daughter wants to try to meet up. She's just started at, you know, in high school, and she wants to meet up with some of her friends who she's never met.
Oh my God. Yeah, I know.
That's really kind of strange. But yeah, it's very interesting, you know, having to do that. But also, you know, you've got to switch a lot of hats, right? You got to go, you know, you're a teacher, and then you're doing tutorials, and then you're working. And so there's a lot of time you're spending in front of a computer doing different things.
Tell me about it. Yeah.
Right.
Okay, I think I'm attached to this chair now.
Yeah, like, I hear you.
Yeah,
I hear you. Now tell me a little bit about Gnomon, because I mean, I did actually some tutorials for the Gnomon workshop.
Right.
About 14 years ago. So
wow. That's
how long it was.
Oh man.
It was 15 years ago is when I did it. So it was for the it was the first V-Ray ones that they did a long, long time ago.
Whoa. Right.
And it was a pretty cool experience and figuring out those tutorials. But I remember, you know, talking to Alex and you know, what he was, you know, sort of telling me to do. And he said, you know, the tutorial is cool, but you really got to make some compelling thing that people look at and goes, oh, I want to do that. And so I have to do that. So what are your, you know, if you're going to do a cool tutorial and teach people how to do stuff, what are sort of the ingredients that you put together to teach people how to, because I saw a little bit of preview of your stuff on Gnomon, which was pretty cool.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The cool thing about Gnomon was they approached me. Jason sent me an email saying, are you interested in doing a tutorial? Mm-hmm. And I was like, I was super excited to do that, of course, because, you know, Gnomon is very well known and they have been doing tutorials for a long time. And I have been using their tutorials to learn myself.
Sure.
And their interesting approach to the artists is the fact that they approach you and say, okay, what do you feel like doing? What do you like to do? That is very refreshing, because they don't tell you, oh, we want a tutorial on this. Can you do it? No, they say, what do you like to do? And then you suggest a couple of things, and then they're like, okay, let's make this one. Mm-hmm. And then you start on it, and they give you complete freedom, and they trust you, you know, wholeheartedly, that mm-hmm. I barely see that happening in this industry, to be honest. And I enjoyed it so much that I am making another one for them now, like in the process of making another one. And when they asked me what I wanted to do, because like doing character creature design is a big passion for me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I said, I can do a fantasy creature, and I showed them like some concepts, and they were like, yeah, let's do it. But I was completely free to name the chapters or, you know, the softwares that I wanted to use were quite open what I wanted to use. Out of which, like, I use V-Ray for my rendering, because I'm really comfortable with V-Ray, and I've been working with V-Ray for a long time. It's like my render engine of choice.
Yeah.
That was like everything from beginning, because as a generalist, I'm used to doing modeling, texturing, and look dev and all that. So I did the concept for it, and I just did it all the way through to the final rendering.
Yeah. But it's kind of fun to sort of come up with that journey, right? Because you sort of have to think, well,
yeah,
if someone's going to learn from what I'm doing,
yeah,
let's make it something compelling and interesting. And I think you're absolutely right when you say that Gnomon, you know, sort of empowers you. That's the thing. They're not just selling someone how to do something. They're selling the person that's doing it. So they're selling you to do it. And so the only way that you're going to do something that's about you is if they give you freedom to be yourself.
Yeah.
Right?
And that's really interesting. Like, and I think because Alex has been a 3D artist himself, he really understands, you know, the mindset of a 3D artist. And he really like respects that, obviously, and gives you freedom, which is really, really, really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. Alex was on our, we did a 24 hours of, 24 Hours of Chaos was our event that we did, and he was one of the speakers on there, and he was talking about, you know, as an educator, some of the struggles with doing remote learning right now. And it's very interesting because, you know, I've been like, yeah, it's great. I work from home. I do my own thing. I don't have to deal with people. But to him, it was like, it's very, very hard for students to do that. But it is really, what's very cool that is that there's still a great resources. There's still things like the Gnome and Worksoft stuff that people can go to and can do during this time. Is also like, hey, you know what? Maybe I'm not working right now. And this is an opportunity for me to step up my game or get to a next level or pick up a new tool or, you know, do something I've never done before. Maybe I'm a matte painter who've always wanted to draw characters or do something like that. And that could be a really good opportunity. Do you find that you spent some time recently learning new tools or learning new things?
That's also because I've started teaching. When you're teaching, you know, you have to kind of dig deeper into stuff that you have always been like overlooking sometimes, you know, because it's not your comfort zone. You know, you're kind of trying to avoid them or do it the other way that you're used to, like, you know, approach a problem from a standpoint of like how you are comfortable tackling it. Mm-hmm. But when you're teaching, you're kind of like exposed to the students and you want to give them the best, you know, the most common and best solution. So you kind of have to, like, for example, if you're like doing your, spec map in polypainting in ZBrush, now it's time to like do that in Mari or in Substance Painter. And like, you have to kind of like, so you have to learn when you're teaching. It's,
Nothing makes you learn more than teaching.
For sure.
Because you're always, when I was teaching, I remember specifically like being terrified if someone asked me a question that I don't know the answer to.
Yeah.
Because then I'm going to come off as a fraud. So I'm like, I learned everything before going into classroom just to make sure that I could answer any questions because I was getting nervous.
For sure.
So that's been really cool. I mean, did you ever think that you'd be sort of so involved in teaching when you started getting into this?
I kind of missed in my bio when I was telling you about my background. I have been teaching back in Iran. I've been teaching because the part I missed was that I switched to IT for some time. I was doing computer networks. And I was, so I got like Microsoft certificates for like MCSE. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Anyway. Yeah.
It's been a long time ago for me, like Windows NT time, you know?
Yep.
And so then I was teaching that in colleges in Iran. So teaching was kind of something, and then my mom is a teacher. My aunties are teachers. Like it's going in the family kind of, I think it's in us, if that's.
So it's true in your blood to teach.
Yeah. And and then it's I like it because, you know, first of all, the dynamic of teaching and getting to meet students and different people with different backgrounds and everything. And since I was an international student, I understand how they feel, how they are. There's that connection as well. And to be able to gain some experience and able to share it and kind of reinforce your experiences as well, because you have to teach them to someone and it kind of empties you in a way that you have to like fill it up and start learning even more stuff to be able to teach, to be kind of ahead of, you know, the whole wave trying to be. It's something that, not necessarily I was teaching in the forefront of my head, but it has always been in my mind to kind of switch to that as well.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting. I've always, you know, thought that, you know, teaching, it's always also good to give back to the community, right? Especially when you learn something and it sort of enables and fosters your career to become the kind of person you want. And I think it's very important that once you do get to the point where you are, to give back the same way that others have given to you. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's what excited me about the Gnomon email. I was like, oh, wow, that is really cool. I really want to do this with them.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Because you learned from Noman and now you can give back to Noman for the same thing. Right?
Yeah.
So that's really cool. Now let's talk a little bit about sculpture. What led your interest in character stuff? And then why did you decide to do it as a 3D? Do you still do clay models or you do mostly ZBrush stuff as well?
Yeah, no, I do clay models, even though since I've always been living in apartments prior to this, I've always been able to work on small size sculptures. So I use Sculpey for a lot of my sculptures, but my sculptures are usually not bigger than that, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And now that we have moved to this house, I've set up a workshop downstairs in the basement, and my plan is to do larger size pieces. I'm still super interested in sculpture because I really appreciate art and art has changed my life. So it's really serious to me, you know, it's a serious thing to me. It's not just, I don't see it as entertainment. I see it as a serious thing. Yeah. And I still do sculptures. And I think that helps doing digital sculpture and vice versa. Doing digital sculpture, sculpting helps your traditional sculpting techniques.
And the other way around too.
And the other way around. Yeah. Okay.
What led you towards creatures? What led you towards characters and those types of things?
I kind of like doing fine art abstract things too, but always with a side of realism to them. Uh-huh. So strange, deformed, organic looking, you know, sculptures are always interesting to me. And creatures and characters, because they're just they have very interesting forms in them.
Yeah.
And I think I got it from, again, watching tool videos, honestly.
Okay. Well, that's really cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool. I think it's interesting that, you know, those are the sort of things that spark something that happened inside of you.
Yeah. And then it kind of becomes subconsciously influential on you.
Yep.
And back then, when I was doing sculpture in Iran by myself, I got this pack of child sculpting clay with different colors. I don't know what you call it in
Play-Doh.
kind of like Play-Doh. And I made this The Big Bad Wolf and Three Little Pigs music video by Green Jello. It's a clay version of the Big Bad Wolf, who's a biker. And then the three little wolves have a lot of character in them.
Right.
So that's one of the first things that I actually made. The characters were really interesting to me. Claymation is really interesting to me. Stop motion is very, very interesting to me. It's something that I am planning on diving deeper into.
Yeah.
I have a short film because I made a short film recently for the first time. And then I'm planning on doing a second one. And the second one, I am planning to have live action and stop motion combined.
Interesting. Interesting. So where did your passion for filmmaking happen after sculpture?
Yeah, art in general, be it music or film or sculpture or painting, I'm always looking at art and looking at films and listening to music all day. So I'm to begin with, I'm a consumer of that. And then I get influenced from that. And a lot of films, especially abstract, surreal, fantasy films have always been a big influence on me. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I've learned a lot from them.
Yeah.
And again, doing the short film that we did, The Seahorse Trainer, was also an attempt to go back to that and revisit it and make something that I actually like to watch. Actually like to watch, because
so
I
made explain this, that. Give the story of that short film and how did that come to be?
Yeah, we made this with Ricardo, Bonisoli, and Rodman Sevilla. So Ricardo and I both we were working at Scanline, and we were sitting across each other, and we became friends. And like one day we were talking about doing a project together, and we really didn't have a clear idea of what to do. And it wasn't necessarily a short film. We were like, okay, maybe we should do like a 3D project together where he does some of the texturing, I do some of the modeling, and we render it and stuff like that, like a collaborative like render kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then there were like ideas back and forth. We were brainstorming different ideas. And then Ricardo came up with this, had this idea. And he said, like, I had this idea of a guy who is a seahorse trainer. And we actually go to his house and interview him, like a mockumentary kind of thing. We interview him about seahorse training. And he tells us like random, you know, strange facts about training seahorses.
Right.
And since we were both like interested in like weird and strange characters and stuff like that, we were like, okay, yeah, that's a cool idea. So we took it from there to, and then in the process of brainstorming, we decided to like change it to actually from a mockumentary to a narrative.
Right.
For lack of a better term, because it's like the narrative is not like a very conventional narrative. But anyway, like decided to turn it into a kind of a narrative, a short film.
Right.
And then we talked to Rodman, our friend who produced the film, and the three of us were sitting together and we were jamming out ideas about what to put in the story. So it was very, very, it's kind of like jamming with musical instruments and improvising. Right. We were kind of doing that with ideas. And then the ideas that we all found interesting, we were like, okay, this is cool. Write it down. And we wrote all the ideas that were cooled down, and then we packed them up as a story, the seahorse trainer. And then me and Ricardo did the direction of the film, and Rodman did the production, the producer.
Right. And how long did it take you guys to do it?
From the very beginning, and keep in mind that we have all of us were visual effects artists, and we were working on this part-time in our spare time. So
yes,
we didn't take time off or anything. And it took us, I think we started back in 2017.
Okay.
And then finished it in 2019. So 2 years.
2 years. Yeah. A lot of work.
Yeah.
A lot of work. Yeah. Well, that's cool. What do you take away from doing that experience? I mean, obviously you want to do more of them. So
probably the most, the best school I have been to, I could say, because none of us had the experience of directing a film or making a film. We have always been involved in post-production and visual effects.
Right. Yep.
And it was kind of scary at the beginning. We were like, okay, we're diving into something that we don't have any experience in. And probably the people we talk to, they're way more experienced than us. Like, let's say, talking to a cinematographer or to the composer, you know, they have been doing this sort of, and they have experience and we don't have any experience. How are we going to manage that?
Right.
But at the same time, you have to, you know, dive into it if you really want to do it. Like, there are fears of unknown when you start something like this.
Sure.
But then if you decide to just like, anyway, I'll see what happens. And I'll just see it as a learning experience. And if we actually can finish the film, we have something in the end on our hand. If not, even if we fail making the actual like film, finish the film, then we have learned something. We have experienced some new things. Right. And we have been exposed to other sides of film production.
Right.
So that was the idea. But then at the same time, we kept the story in a way that we could actually manage to do it with our visual effects skills. Right. Yeah. And also we relied heavily on doing storyboard, planning everything ahead because we lack on-set experience. We were like, okay, we should have a roadmap that we can share with everyone. And so everybody's on the same page because probably on the set it's going to be pretty hectic and crazy, which it was.
Yeah.
But having that storyboard, and we even made animatic for it, having the storyboard and animatic really helped us to be able to communicate the ideas to the different crew.
Right.
And to be honest with you, like the finished film is very, very close. If you see the storyboards, the finished film is very similar to the storyboards in terms of even like framing and everything.
Right.
Because we planned it ahead, and that was, I think that was the right thing we did. And right. We actually, if we didn't do that, I think we wouldn't have been able to finish the film, because
sure.
It would have been crazy.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, and there's, you know, a lot of time wasted on set with things you don't need. So you should make sure you use that. And being on set's expensive. So you want to.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
It's, man, it's so like, it was the most intense 3 days of my life, probably.
Was the being on set. Yeah.
Being on set. But at the same time, most joyful. Like when I think about it, I'm like, yeah, that was so, like, I want to do that again. I want to feel that. Energy again. It was really interesting.
Yeah, for sure. And then what, I mean, what do you, obviously you must have learned a lot, and a lot of respect for the whole, you know, learning, you know, about a DP, how things can come on set, and you know, why you know, you work with all those the assets when you're doing post-production, but now you know how they got there, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you always see these like plates in visual effects, and then you don't know like what happened there on set, but having that experience actually helps with the post-production as well. Like if you have that experience, I feel like you have a better understanding of what's going on and how to read those things. And you know, it's just, as even as a visual effects artist, I think it helped me.
Well, cool. Well, let's talk a little bit about your visual effects work. So can you talk, you know, talk to us, so tell us a little bit about some, I mean, obviously Scanline does amazing film. So what are some of your favorite projects that you worked on at Scanline?
Well, at Scanline, I've worked on so many different films. Uh-huh. The very first thing I was working on, because it was my first experience in film, probably stands out than the rest, not because the film was any better or anything like that. It was a different experience. And it was Pan.
Pan. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The crystal cave. We were working on that sequence.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That sounds pretty, pretty cool. So, and, what is your main, obviously you still do a lot character work there, right? Or are you sort of much more generalist or everything?
Yeah, I kind of do, like right now I'm doing mostly look dev there.
Oh, okay.
When I was in, before I went back to Scanline, I was doing a lot of look dev and method as well. And both these places actually, like, because they're both using V-Ray and I'm really comfortable with it, I think like the results I can get in a timely manner, I think is beneficial to the company.
Right.
So I ended up doing a lot of look dev for them.
Okay.
But yeah, anything from characters to sometimes buildings to, it's not just specifically characters all the time.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So you do spend a lot of time in look dev, which is fun.
I do. Yeah. Yeah.
That's fun. I mean, working on that, I mean, I don't know how it works at Scanline, but you know, it depends on the company, but sometimes look dev only does shading and then everyone else, you know, they do textures, but do you do a little bit of texturing and sculpturing?
Oh, I do. Well? Yeah. I do texture and look dev, I must say. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause they should go hand in hand, I think, honestly.
Yeah. If I have to go back and change something in texture, you know, color correct something or add some details and stuff like that, I do it myself. And kind of like generalist in different places, generalists mean different things. In some places they expect you to do lighting. Right. But at Scanline, I'm doing texturing and look dev. And in the past, I have done a lot of modeling at Scanline as well. I've actually done facial blend shapes for Steppenwolf on Justice League, the previous Justice League.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So anything from... And some people say, like, what are you exactly doing? You're working on blend shapes now, and then the next day you're working on look dev.
Right.
Like, yeah, I mean, I like all of those things. I get bored if I do just one thing.
That's good. Well, what do you think? I mean, you know, you've been doing this for a while now. So How do you think that, you know, do you think look dev has changed a lot in the way that has happened in the last, you know, several years?
For sure. Yeah. I mean, the PBR and like, I think Substance and how it just bakes you all the textures and you just assign the materials, I think that was kind of a game changer, even though Substance has not been as widely used in film than in games. But I think it's coming to film as well. And that whole process kind of changes the way you have to set up your shaders and everything. Like, if it's streamlined into the pipeline of a company, then you really have to stick to it. And you're not, you know, sometimes, like, in the past, like, spec map was a thing. Now it's kind of not a thing at all anymore. It's like, you know, you don't attach anything as a spec map. It's like reflection color and IOR and roughness, but
that is correct.
Yeah.
You should. In fact, I've never thought spec maps are incorrect mathematically speaking, because everything is 100% reflective. It's just the IOR that's the difference.
Yeah, exactly.
I agree.
Yeah. So at least for me, working at that time, like in the past, where IOR was not a big thing, but spec map was a big thing.
Yeah.
Now I feel like there's this like switch of, oh, spec map is bad, out of the image, and now do it with IOR.
Yeah. But it's also interesting because, you know, if you think about Substance, sorry, we're going to get a little geeky if that's okay.
Sure.
If you think about Substance and what that does, really, one of the biggest reasons why PBR became big specifically for the game industry wasn't necessarily that it was more correct, although it is compared to what gamers were using before or game industry was using before. It was mainly because it allowed them to reduce the amount of maps that they needed to do it. And maps is memory, which they don't have on the graphics card. So it was really about like reducing how much you do. And I think it's interesting that it sort of became that default in that way, don't you?
Yeah. Limitations spark creativity, I guess.
Yes, it's true. But it's also like, you know, I think there's some interesting, I wasn't always a big fan of PBR, and actually, no, I'm not a fan of the term metalness. I do not like that term. I think that term does not describe anything in nature. No, nothing is measured by its metalness. It's either a metal, it's either metallic, or it's either conductive or dielectric, which is. That's the only thing. Then they use the term metalness. I'm like, I don't know anything that has a measurable metalness.
It's a non-metal paper or like fabric.
Yeah. But the problem is when people use gray colors for metalness, which is like, that's half plastic, half metals don't exist. So that's the problem.
Right.
But, but anyway, it's really interesting. I think it's cool that Substance has sort of infiltrated. Do you think that, so I don't want you to, you know, pick tools or anything, but I'm really wondering, like, do you think Substance is starting to get more attention in the film industry? Because obviously when I was doing it a long time ago, pretty much the only, you know, texture drawing tool was Mari, which was everyone was using Mari. But do you think Substance is sort of penetrating the film market a little bit more? And if so, what is the attraction towards it compared to other traditional tools that people were used before?
Right. I think it takes time for companies to actually switch completely to a newer software because it's too costly for them. And, you know, the pipeline has been refined around certain softwares. And now if you want to kind of put that aside and bring something new to the pipeline, there's going to be some time of like refining your pipeline tools for that particular software.
Yep.
But I see more and more places using it for sure. Like then, let's say, I don't know, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, it's definitely starting to gain more interest in film.
Yeah. Okay.
And I think, but there are limitations or there have been limits. I'm not a very like a big expert on Substance, but as far as I know, they have added like tiles and stuff in it, which makes it a better candidate for film.
Yes.
But Mari is also so powerful in handling large textures and a lot of tiles that I don't think that Substance at the time, at least, is able to like carry assets like that massive and huge, or at least it's not like optimized for that right now. Mm-hmm. Again, don't quote me on it, of course, because I'm not a big Substance expert.
Right.
But from what I know, still Mari has its place, and I honestly myself prefer it. If I may say so.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just curious about that, because obviously when Substance came around, it changed how people are organizing their textures. They sort of, and I'm sure Mari reacted to that as well, right? So Mari now obviously has PBR shading as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And the way I use Mari is actually kind of like I make my Substance version of Mari, where I make all these channels that are connected and interconnected, and like I use a lot of like shared layers and stuff. And I am actually looking at my work shaded in Mari.
Okay.
And in a sense, it's kind of like creating your own Substance version in Mari. And I again, we're using V-Ray, I'm using the V-Ray material in Mari to evaluate my textures and everything as I am working.
Yep.
I'm seeing renders with the HDRIs and everything.
Right. There's the same thing in Substance now, by the way. I wrote a whole blog post about it. So you can actually use a V-Ray shading.
Oh, cool. Okay. Yeah, that's great.
not to say that Substance or Mari, but I think you're absolutely right. The thing that was amazing about Substance, especially even back in the day, like a long time ago, is you could draw 8K textures all day long and it would be fine. You know, it would manage that. You needed a big graphics card, but you could still manage it, right? So
yeah,
it's a very powerful powerful tool for sure.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because I think the textures and the way things are looking, obviously, you know, I've seen your work. Your work is extremely detailed. There's a lot of detail. You don't go for subtle and soft. You go for extremely detailed and gritty and lots of texture and in there. So I think it's really fascinating that you know the kind of work you do.
Thank you.
And when you started doing 3D work, you said you obviously said you were working in 3D studio in DOS. Yeah. way back when. But when you started doing more 3D work, did you sort of jump right into ZBrush?
Yeah.
ZBrush was your first thing you started with, right?
ZBrush was, yeah. So when I was in high school, actually, I was using 3ds Max, the discrete, version of 3ds Max. And I actually started translating 3D Studio Help into Farsi to publish it as a book.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and okay. I did that. Yeah, and I did that for a while, and then I gave it up. But anyway, and then after that, I wasn't touching any 3D application after that. And and then when I wanted to restart in 3D, yes, ZBrush is what I picked up.
Okay.
And I don't remember which version of ZBrush it was. Probably 3 or something. I'm not really sure. But then, again, like watching Mitzmeyer tutorials and Scott Spencer tutorials on Gnomon, on ZBrush was the way I learned ZBrush. And then when I enrolled in animation for the one-year animation course that I was enrolled in, I already knew ZBrush. I didn't know much about Maya. So Maya was, that is when I started to learn Maya.
Okay.
But my gateway drug was ZBrush into the
world.
Yeah.
Because I think that ZBrush specifically, you know, sort of when it came, you know, it hit the world of concept art and creature design like a storm. Because before then, it was very hard to try to get your sculpture into 3D. I mean, you can just ask Alex Alvarez how he used to model everything with NURB patches, right? I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah.
If you think about
it's
it.
It's unbelievable.
So now using ZBrush obviously changed that and was a very liberating tool. Do you think, I mean, what do you think the next big thing for sculpting is going to become in a digital world? What do you think is going to be the next thing that people are going to look forward to?
Well, it seems like ZBrush has carried very strongly all these years, even though there's like, I don't know, Autodesk has like Mudbox, which like coming from a big giant company like Autodesk, you would expect Modbox to like be able to replace ZBrush easily. But I think ZBrush is providing so much specific tools, even though it's kind of weird in a sense, like the tools are very different than other 3D packages. And I think if I didn't start on ZBrush and I knew Maya and I wanted to go to ZBrush, I probably would have given up on it because, you know.
Mudbox is much closer to Maya.
Yeah. Yeah. But because I started with ZBrush and like I didn't know anything about 3D when I started with ZBrush or not much, it wasn't that weird to me. But I understand that it's the I think a lot of people pick up ZBrush and then they give up because of the difference in the tools and the methods of doing things.
Right.
But that being said, it's such a intuitive piece of software that just carried on all these years in spite of the competition. So I am not sure what can replace ZBrush, honestly. Maybe...
I'm not saying it should be replaced, but what is the next ZBrush? What's ZBrush going to be next? Or what's going to be the next wave in sculpting?
Yeah, I think being able to work on a tablet, like iPad, and recently I'm seeing a lot of like people talking. I was seeing a lot of people talking about Nomad, and I downloaded it. And previously I was on my iPad. I was using, what was it called? The other one.
I don't know much about the tools on the iPad.
So there was another.
What
famous
is Nomad?
One.
Explain what Nomad is. I don't know.
Nomad is very similar to ZBrush. It's very very similar to ZBrush, and I think when they have made it, they have looked at ZBrush a lot, like to see which tools to implement, and even the brushes are very similar to ZBrush.
Okay,
but it's not made by Pixelogic,
right?
But it's also a texture painting application, and you can shade in it too. So it's like kind of a mixture, a smaller sister of ZBrush plus Substance Painter. It's kind of a mix of the two. And I feel like that is also a thing. And also probably VR sculpting is going to be sometime in the future is going to be a big thing.
Have you tried VR sculpting?
Well, I just got my let me show you this. Actually now that we talk. So I just got this very recently, just to be able to experiment with that, Medium, Adobe Medium.
Yeah.
It's really interesting, man. It's very different. It's a very different experience. And the freedom of being able to do it in virtual reality makes the tools a little different as well, but even more intuitive. And for example, let's say you want to do a stroke and you want the stroke to gradually fade away. Mm-hmm. You have the option of getting your pen closer to your model, or you have the option of when you are doing it, you hold your pen still and then you make the model further than to your brush to fade it.
So you can... Yeah.
So it kind of changes the dynamic of sculpting. Which is not really something you do in ZBrush. So you always rely on your pen pressure. But here you're doing that. And it's kind of weird, but it's interesting. I enjoyed it. I haven't had much time to work with it, unfortunately, yet. But I feel like it has big potential. Especially maybe for traditional sculptors, too, they would be more into it.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting. And I think also, you know, the other thing that I think is interesting that came up in the sculpting idea, and this is during a conversation I actually had with Aaron Sims, is like looking at sculpture in VR, evaluating it in VR. Do you know what I mean? Oh, are you there?
Yes,
I lost you for a second. So looking at your sculpture and evaluating your work in VR, what do you think about that and that as an idea?
It's exciting because you're close to your sculpture and you're not seeing anything else. So when you're doing it on the computer, your peripheral vision is seeing all the different things, but here you're one to one with your sculpture, And you can actually go around and see the other side, which is super weird, man. Like, it's really strange in a very good way.
In a very good way. But you can also pick it up and make it smaller and twist it if you want to.
Yeah. For sure.
But being able to walk around it, because also there's another thing, you know, sometimes it's hard to sense scale. And then suddenly if you put it into scale, you can really get an idea of how big or small something is, right?
Yeah. And you can make your sculpture bigger than you and like look up at it and
That is like cool.
I was playing a game on Oculus and I was just like, I don't think normal people do that, but I was like just looking at the textures and like bringing my hand up and like looking at my glove, like studying, like looking at all the textures, and it was so cool, so interesting. It's just a very different experience.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. That's really cool. Well, dude, this has been really cool to talk to you and, you know, find out about all the awesome things you're doing. You're obviously a very busy man, you know, working as a teacher and, you know, doing your Gnomon workshop and doing your day job with Scanline, or I won't call it a day job because you can pick your own hours a little bit more. but it's been really great. I mean, I'm so glad that Lynette was able to do this introduction for us and get this working, because it's really cool. And I'm a big fan of you know, the work that Gnomon Workshop did, because honestly speaking, that was one of the things that helped me get on the map in terms of my knowledge of V-Ray as well, was because of the Gnomon Workshop stuff. So I really want to give back, just the same way that you're doing. I want to give back to Gnomon for helping me with the things that I've done. So that's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you for having me. And sorry if I talked too much and bored you to death with
stories. You did not at all. It was really great having you, and I appreciate you coming on. Have a great Friday.
Yeah, you too. And so this is going to be published. Do you have any idea about like?
I don't know the actual date, but Kristen will let you know. It's probably about 4 or 5 weeks from now, maybe a little bit more when it comes out.
Okay, cool.
All right, man. Have a good one.
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, you too. Bye.